This week on the Best of Flashpoints, the nation's Jeremy Scahill rips the lid off a breaking story about the founder and owner of Blackwater, implicated in serious murder and weapons smuggling charges. Also, Israel's expanding ethnic cleansing programs in occupied East Jerusalem makes more Palestinian families homeless. Hillary Clinton's Africa strategies. We'll talk to Kimbale Musavuli of Friends of the Congo about U.S. policies in that country. And South Bronx activists win a people's victory and make a stand for immigrant rights. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we return to Blackwater, where there is major and significant news. Let me read to you a story broken by Jeremy Scahill in The Nation magazine, just a little bit. A former Blackwater employee and an ex-U.S. Marine who has worked as a security operative for the company have made a series of explosive allegations in sworn statements filed on August 3rd in federal court in Virginia. The two men claim that the company's owner, Eric Prince, may have murdered or facilitated the murder of individuals who were cooperating with federal authorities investigating the company. There are many other profoundly serious accusations that have to do with the wanton killing of Muslims. Joining us from New York City at the headquarters of Nation magazine is Jeremy Scahill. Jeremy, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Great to be back with you, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And the allegations go that Eric Prince went after these guys because they were part of an investigation into Blackwater. Before we get into the actual substance of these statements given under oath, what was the investigation about? What were they going after Blackwater for?
Well, you know, there has been an investigation ongoing by the U.S. Justice Department at least since late 2007, following the Nisr Square massacre in Baghdad in September of 2007, where 17 Iraqi civilians were gunned down in a central square in Baghdad by heavily armed Blackwater operatives. A grand jury was convened in the aftermath of that incident to investigate Blackwater and other mercenary companies, and out of that, there were five indictments of Blackwater shooters. No executives, no administration officials, but five guys who did the trigger pulling, allegedly, and then a sixth individual pled guilty to one count of manslaughter. So the investigation into Blackwater for Nisr Square was one aspect of it. There also was a grand jury that was sitting and hearing testimony in North Carolina examining allegations that Blackwater was involved with weapons smuggling. The way that grand juries work is you don't necessarily know that they're even active grand juries, but what we do know for a fact is that the criminal investigation into various aspects of Blackwater's operations is very much active and ongoing. In fact, I've heard from some sources that more indictments may be coming down imminently on other figures within Blackwater. So there's a very serious criminal investigation, a congressional investigation, an IRS investigation, a State Department investigation. The company's being investigated from multiple angles. And so the allegation here on the part of two former Blackwater people, one of whom, as you said, was a U.S. Marine, the other, referred to in the papers as John Doe number two, I have learned from sources, was a member of Blackwater's management and had knowledge of Blackwater's operations. They're saying that Eric Prince, either himself or his associates, murdered or had murdered, in other words, facilitated the murder of people that were cooperating or planning to cooperate with federal authorities in their investigation. It's unclear what investigation. There's so many of them.
All right. Talk about the depth of these statements, how compelling they are, and why they would be believable.
All right. Well, first of all, I want to say that I've talked to various people from Blackwater off the record over the years, people that were currently working for Blackwater, people that used to work for Blackwater. Several of the things contained in these affidavits I've heard from other Blackwater personnel, such as the smuggling of weapons and dog food, Prince having this sort of Christian crusader mentality, and in fact trying to hire people who shared his worldview about eliminating Muslims and the Islamic faith. Those weren't shocking statements to me at all. It's shocking that the Obama administration continues to work with them, but we'll talk about that in a moment. I think that on the issue of credibility, you have to look at this from this perspective. It is a very serious crime to give sworn testimony under threat of perjury in as sensitive of an investigation as this. If these were simply people that had an axe to grind, they are taking an incredible risk by making these kinds of statements. They have very, very little to gain by giving these sworn statements. So I think that right off the bat, you have to look at what would their motive be. The other part of this, though, is that John Doe, number one, appears to be facing an immediate redeployment to Iraq. He may even still be working with Blackwater. If not, he's working with another company. So I think that what we have here are two people that worked for Blackwater over a period of years, and I think they either became disillusioned with what they saw as a company that claimed to be patriotic and was in fact carrying out the personal or religious agenda of the owner of the company, Eric Prince, or people that saw activity that they considered to be criminal in nature and decided that they didn't want to be a part of it.
All right. Now, what are the precise details regarding either the ordering of murders by Eric Prince or his actual participation in these murders? How can we enforce that claim?
Well, I mean, I don't think that when you say we, I don't think that any journalist can enforce that claim. I'll tell you everything that I know about this at this point that can be stated publicly, and that is that I did diligence when I first obtained these affidavits, these sworn statements. I began to call various people, some of them within government, some of them outside of government, that would have some form of knowledge over this. My understanding is that these individuals provided this information to federal prosecutors already, and that John Doe number two has actually testified in front of a grand jury. I tried to get the Justice Department to confirm that, and they would neither confirm nor deny it. When I asked the Justice Department, actually the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C., if they had a criminal investigation opened into Eric Prince on murder charges, they said that they would not talk about actions that they're taking or not taking against an uncharged individual. And I think that what we have here is the beginning, the very, very beginning of what is going to be a long process of investigating Eric Prince's potential role in these unidentified murders. At this point, there was no individual identified as having been a victim of any Prince ordered or Prince carried out murder when it comes to those specific allegations. There's a whole other element to this, which very few media outlets have discussed, and that is the issue of whether or not Prince could be culpable for killings of his men in Iraq and charged with murder under either federal law in the United States, Virginia law, or North Carolina law because of his alleged knowledge that he was deploying men who wanted to kill Muslims and join his Christian crusade against Islam. If that's true, under North Carolina, Virginia, and federal law, the lawyers suing Blackwater argue that he could be criminally charged with murder.
Now, my understanding is that he was using the name crusading under the Knights of the Templar.
Right.
he sort of gave this crusade a name.
Well, I mean, you know, the Templar Knights, the Knights of Malta. You know, these are figures that remain relevant to very radical right wing, particularly Catholics, and that's what Eric Prince is. He's a convert to Catholicism. We can call him a theoconservative, as Damon Linker, who wrote the great book on it, characterizes this movement of people. You know, Prince joined the Catholic Church. He was part of the Dutch Reformed Church. His whole family was not Catholic. He joined the Church. I've heard from people because he wanted to be closer to the tradition of the true Crusades. He married a Catholic woman. He converted to Catholicism. He's become, I think in his eyes, a sort of neo-crusader in the early stages of the so-called War on Terror. What they're doing, though, in terms of making up names, is that they're apparently taking terminology from the Knights of the Templar and using them as their call signs, you know, their nicknames in the field. And we're also, my understanding is we're going to hear more about that and more specifics about that. The testimony that we have here has Prince going out and essentially allowing men to be deployed in Iraq who have expressed hatred for Muslims, use slurs for Muslims and who appear to want to go to Iraq with the explicit purpose of killing what they call Haji. You know, I'll quote from one of the affidavits. This is from John Doe number 2. Mr. Prince intentionally deployed to Iraq certain men who shared his vision of Christian supremacy, knowing and wanting these men to take every available opportunity to murder Iraqis. Many of these men used call signs based on the Knights of the Templar, the warriors who fought the Crusades. Mr. Prince, this is a continued quote, operated his companies in a manner that encouraged and rewarded the destruction of Iraqi life. For example, Mr. Prince's executives would openly speak about going over to Iraq to, quote, lay Hajis out on cardboard, close quote. Going to Iraq to shoot and kill Iraqis was viewed as a sport or game. Mr. Prince's employees openly and consistently used racist and derogatory terms for Iraqis and other Arabs, such as ragheads or Hajis. Dennis, it's important to note, the quote I just read you there comes from a 4-year employee of Blackwater who worked in the company's management.
Wow. We're speaking with Jeremy Scahill. His article appears in The Nation, dated August 4th, 2009. Blackwater founder implicated in murder. Yes, that's what we're talking about. Also, these informants, Doe 1 and 2, outline a process by which Prince is involved in weapon smuggling into Iraq. You talked a little bit about that, money laundering, obstructing the federal investigation.
Yep.
So it's not just the accusations of murder in terms of his disrupting the investigation, and he's involved in other very heavy crimes, or so it's alleged.
Right. I mean, you know, Eric Prince has, a whole aviation division of his company called Presidential Airlines. And the one of the allegations that's made by John Doe number 1, the former U.S. Marine, was that Blackwater, he says quite bluntly, Blackwater was smuggling weapons in Iraq. And he says that when he first got to Iraq, right away, he personally witnessed weapons being pulled out from dog food bags. Now, I've heard from other sources that Blackwater was also using unauthorized weapons, and that's also fleshed out a bit here, that they were using these blended metal bullets from a U.S. company in Arkansas called Lamas, and these are bullets that would explode when they entered the human body. In fact, I tell the story of one individual in my book who used these weapons and bragged about it openly. He shot an Iraqi man in his buttocks, and it exploded the entire left side of his body. And when the U.S. military learned that a Blackwater guy used those weapons, they threatened him with a court-martial until they realized that he was no longer working with the active-duty military. The allegation here is that Prince was not only smuggling unauthorized weapons into Iraq, but Doe number 2 says that Prince was making money off of it. The direct quote is that he generated, this is Prince directly, not Blackwater, he generated substantial revenues from participating in the illegal arms trade. That's a direct quote from John Doe number 2.
Again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Jeremy Scahill. Jeremy Scahill is a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at the Nation Institute. His article is about potential allegations, really, that the founder of Blackwater, still we're going to talk about its relationship to the U.S. government then and now in one moment. But I also want to tell people, Jeremy, that you're a correspondent for Democracy Now! And you have been investigating this situation around Blackwater for a long time. Your book is Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. And
sounds like we might be writing one called Blackwater, The Fall of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army next.
The Rise and Fall, huh? Where have I heard that phrase before?
Exactly. Quite biblical of you, Dennis.
Yeah. Well, listen, Jeremy, I think part of the power of the story is the fact that this company, Blackwater, has had an extraordinary relationship in war fighting in Iraq. I'm not sure exactly what's going on in Afghanistan. What I want to ask you now is, has that relationship continued? Is the Obama administration working with Blackwater or its most recent incarnation?
I mean, the short answer is yes. In fact, I mean, I before I came on your show, I knew you were going to ask me about this, and so I decided to go and check recent contract activity of Blackwater. And this is by no means the exclusive financial relationship right now, but I'm just going to give you an example. On July 31st, 2009, there was a contract signed with Blackwater for $20,985,000.
That's a week ago. That's a week ago. Yeah.
One week ago. $20,985,683 on July 31st, 2009. And it identifies as the completion date of the contract 9/03/2009, so September of 2009. And the place of the work performance is designated as, guess it, Dennis, Iraq. So the Obama administration claims to have not renewed Blackwater's contract. They say, well, Blackwater's no longer working in Iraq. And here we have, July 31st, 2009, a $20 million payment going over to Blackwater for providing security services in Iraq. In Afghanistan, Blackwater continues to work, continues to win contracts. They work for the Drug Enforcement Administration, as well as the United States State Department. Their aviation division continues to work there, and Blackwater has been bidding on contracts to fight parts of the so-called war on drugs, which is really a counterinsurgency program in Latin America. Yes, the Obama administration continues to use Blackwater, but more to the point, the Obama administration has increased the use of armed contractors in Afghanistan by 29% in just the second quarter of 2009. In Iraq, we've seen a 23% increase in the number of armed contractors present in the country because Obama's keeping that 80 football field size embassy there. So we have a situation where Obama has basically maintained the status quo in Iraq and is expanding the use of these forces in Afghanistan. He's just using different human rights abusing companies as his primary ones instead of Blackwater.
And of course, given that it's now being leaked that they'll double the war fighting capacities in Afghanistan, that's what the advisors are telling Obama. We can expect that there will be an increase, an extensive and heavy increase in its relationship with these private contractors. So it is of the utmost importance. Now, just to follow up on this, Jeremy, these John Doe 1 and 2 are giving depositions under oath to federal prosecutors, right?
Well, they both claim these particular depositions were given to the lawyers that are working on behalf of the Iraqis suing Blackwater. But in a way, it's the same difference. They're sworn under threat of perjury. So it carries the same weight. I mean, there would be criminal implications if they're lying.
Now, obviously what I'm getting to here is it possible that the Obama administration is not aware of these potential problems?
No, I think, I mean, look, I'm going to be really, really blunt here. In saying this, Barack Obama understands very well what the issue is here. I know that from dealing with his staff on the campaign trail and the Senate trail. In a way, it makes it even worse that he allows this system to flourish. Obama was one of a handful of senators that actually got this issue. The problem is that he elected to then put forward legislation that brought the industry closer to power in Washington rather than pushing it further away from power. He understands this. He wants to regulate these companies, not do away with them, not ban them. And in a way, I think it's kind of worse because he actually does understand the stakes here. He does understand what they do. When it comes, though, to this criminal investigation, I believe that the Justice Department is conducting a very wide-ranging investigation, and I do believe that they will be looking at the role of management officials within Blackwater. I know this from various sources. I also wouldn't be shocked if nothing happens to these guys. But I think that and this is one of those instances where if prosecutors are doing their job, they're going to look at the full range of crimes. And if they're hearing this kind of testimony in front of grand juries, I think that it's going to give Eric Holder very serious pause before he decides to throw it away. He might be bad right now, terribly bad, on the issue of torture and the CIA, et cetera. But I know that there are some very serious prosecutors that are working on this and do understand the extent of the criminality.
Jeremy, this story obviously reflects and represents some of the worst fears that we have all had about the privatizing of war. And we also have to ask the question about the relationship. We have been investigating, you and many of us, what's been going on in terms of the Bush administration and the wide-ranging use of torture and kidnapping. Where does a privatized torture company or an assassination company come into this? What is the relationship between the federal government and this kind of investigation? Are these war crimes, do they reflect back on the government? Are they prosecutable in this context?
Look, I mean, I firmly believe that what we're talking about here are war crimes. I also believe that the U.S. military has committed, you know, widespread war crimes. Let's not for a minute act as though, you know, Blackwater's crimes somehow dwarf those of, you know, of any other major player in Iraq that the U.S. has sent over there. There have been plenty of murders committed by U.S. soldiers working under an official chain of command, in theory with a system of accountability. The other part of this is that Blackwater's revenue, 90% of Blackwater's revenue comes from the federal government. It's essentially, you know, a private wing of the government. 90% of their money comes from U.S. taxpayers. Who should be responsible for this? If we lived in a just society, it would be Condoleezza Rice, and it would be George W. Bush, and it would be Dick Cheney. That's the chain of command that Blackwater was under for most of their time in Iraq. You know, we can talk until we're blue in the face how bad Eric Prince is, and he's a bad apple. And I don't use that in the sense that Rumsfeld used it. I mean that he's a particularly bad apple in a box full of rotten apples, which is this whole system. So, but the people that sent him there, they're the ones that are ultimately culpable. And until the Democrats aren't going to spine up and do this because it's not in their interest, because they do the same things when they're in power. So, you know, I don't think we're going to see any kind of real accountability here. Under U.S. law, there should be. Under international law, there should be. But you and I, Dennis, we were born at night, but not last night. This isn't going to happen.
All right. Forget the prosecutions for a moment. I note in your article in The Nation that you've got a comment from Congressman Dennis Kucinich, and he says, quote, "If these allegations are true, Blackwater has been a criminal enterprise defrauding taxpayers and murdering innocent civilians." Any other official reaction?
No, well, I mean, I did talk to the Justice Department and got their sort of official denial. I've heard from other people on Capitol Hill that both the oversight and intelligence committees are going to be looking into this. Whether it's going to turn into an outright investigation, I don't know. I would imagine this would be of great interest, though, to some in the Congress who've been paying attention to this issue. But look, you look at the way it happened with the corporate media. You know, with the exception of Keith Olbermann last night, who had me on, this story was widely ignored until this afternoon when CNN put something on their wire, and then they sort of gave the permission for everybody else to start reporting on it, and now it's in the Washington or the Wall Street Journal and some other papers, etc. But you know, this is another classic case of all these timid corporate journalists sitting around waiting for one of them to dare to stick their foot in the water.
And how have the big press dealt with Blackwater?
You know, I mean, it's I would botch the quote if I tried to do it. But you know that old saying about, you know, first they laugh at you and it goes on from there, and then they eventually take you seriously, and then they put you in jail and torture you. But the point I would make here is that most of the corporate media outlets completely ignored this story for years, or it was sporadic or incident-based coverage. And you know, for instance, when my book came out initially at the beginning of 2006 for the first time, it was completely ignored. No newspaper reviewed it at all. No corporate media outlets would have me on. I was on Jon Stewart, and he kind of tried to make fun of me. What's your issue? This isn't a problem. You know, then bam, one day they go and they kill 17 innocent Iraqis, and the military says this is a crime scene and this was an unprovoked killing. And then all of a sudden it was like, you know, all of them woke up and said, wow, there's this private army in Iraq. This is a classic case of how corporate media operate. You have unembedded journalists, people like Dar Jamail, who you guys have had on regularly, and others who actually go to these places, spend time there. They're unembedded. They can bring you the real story. Those reporters talk about this stuff all the time. Only when something really bad happens do these corporate journalists wake up to it, and that's what happened in this case. So, you know, and now we have these allegations once again. I'll tell you something, Dennis, that I haven't said publicly. I offered this story to a very prominent media outlet, and they didn't do it. And I didn't say, I want to write it. I said, you do this story. It'll have more of an impact if you do it. They didn't touch it. You know, so I said, all right, I'm just going to write it up myself. That's how I ended up doing this story.
Interesting. Speaking with Jeremy Scahill, his story is Blackwater founder implicated in murder based on sworn testimony given by several former employees in the know. I guess I want to push you here, Jeremy, as we get ready to say goodbye. So what are the big questions for you right now? Who would you like to ask what?
What I'm looking into now is, I think it's going to be important to determine, and I've been trying to do this, who was alleged to have been murdered by Prince or his associates or ordered murdered by them? Is it one person? Is it more than one person? Are they U.S. citizens? Were they Blackwater employees? Were they former Blackwater employees? Were they Iraqis? Were they Iraqi civilians? Were they Iraqis that had testified in front of the grand jury? Who were the individuals alleged to have been killed by Eric Prince or by Eric Prince's associates or on Eric Prince's orders or on his associates' orders? I also am going to be very interested to see what happens in terms of any congressional intervention here, if there's going to be an investigation, an attempt to subpoena documents, an attempt to question Eric Prince himself. And then finally, I think that we need to be looking at if there are actually going to be criminal charges brought against Eric Prince or his number two man for many years, Gary Jackson, at Blackwater. Those are the things I'm going to be looking into and working the phones and sources and trying to determine who, if anyone, was murdered by these people, why were they murdered, and what was their role? And then is there going to be a congressional investigation? Is there going to be a criminal indictment brought down against Prince individually?
Any word from Prince himself?
Well, yeah, I mean, Blackwater, I tried repeatedly during the course of working on the story to get them to comment. They never comment for me on anything. They just ignore me. But I did talk to someone who told me when I reached someone on the phone, and they said that they didn't have anyone who could help me with that. And I said, well, do you want to know what I'm calling about? And they said, no, someone will get back to you on it if it's a need-to-know basis. So whatever that means, it was truly like speaking to a Martian. But the other part of it is that Blackwater today released a statement saying that that the lawyers for the Iraqis are trying to litigate this in the media, and that the lawyers are slandering Eric Prince, and that these accusations are offensive, that they're going to respond to them formally on August 17th in a legal brief.
Yeah, I did see that, unsubstantiated and offensive. Of course, that's what we call in the business the non-denial denial. They didn't say they didn't do it.
You tell me, Dennis, you have the statement in front of you. Does it say in there anywhere that Eric Prince did not do that?
I don't have the whole statement, but I looked at all the stories, and there's no denial of the crime.
I mean, I would be very. I'm gonna look very. I don't know. I'd be interested for your listeners to look into. Also, I've been too busy today and haven't read the full statement. But I would very much like to see it. I think it would be. It'll be interesting to see if he says flat out it's completely false.
All right. Well, we're gonna leave it right there, Jeremy Scahill. We thank you for the time. We'll stay with you on the story. A very important story that you've been on top of. If people want to read more deeply about it, Blackwater: The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thank you, Dennis. Great to be on the show.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. In April, I reported from occupied East Jerusalem for Flashpoints and Interpress Service about the looming evictions being faced by the Palestinian residents of the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood as Israeli settlers began taking over chunks of the area, house by house, as Israeli police and occupation forces violently acted on their behalf.
My name is Maher Hannoun. I'm living at Jerusalem at the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. And I give you a little speech about our neighborhood. It's about 28 houses. We are 500 people living here. And we are took those houses from Jordanian government and UNRWA, which is mean that we are here legally, because there is an agreement between us and between Jordanian government. So the Israeli came at 72, they claimed that they own this land. And we are at the court since 37 years. And I will tell you about our situation now. Now they claim that they own this land and we have to pay money as a rent. So our lawyer bring a lot of documents, more than 13 documents, which prove that a Palestinian guy is on this land. But the problem here that the court, she didn't want to hear and she didn't want to see all those documents. I hope there is a justice here, but I don't think, because as I told you, 37 years we are suffering at the court, and they don't want to see the documents. Always they said, you are late to bring the documents. And the settlers don't late, they bring a document which they claim they own this land before 130 years. They don't late, but we are late.
And apparently these kinds of documents are often forged, the settlers' documents that they bring to the court. You know, like they're fake.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about why the Israeli courts would favor the fake documents brought by the illegal settlers and not respect the actual documents brought by the indigenous Palestinians of this area?
Also, not the court helped the settlers. Also, three departments in Israel, which is especially for the paper, also they help it, because they know, as I see you, that they fake the paper and they don't give any attention or any matter for this. Also, the court helped him with a very bad decision, which gave it to us. They helping him with this fake paper. So they need the land empty without people. That's the reason. They need all the land here at East Jerusalem, and they want empty Jerusalem from Palestinian people. To let 1 million settlers came and live here.
How many Palestinians live in the Sheikh Jarrah area, do you know?
At our neighborhood live 500 person, but at the old Sheikh Jarrah about 2,000 person. And there is planning to damage our houses and build 200 houses for settlement. Also not here, also at this neighborhood, they will build 36 houses at land, and also they will to build another 100 houses for another land, which is mean they want to cut East Jerusalem by settlement to let the Palestinian people, they can't reach the old city and Al-Aqsa and the church there also.
Yesterday, Israeli forces swarmed Sheikh Jarrah and forcibly evicted the Hanun and Al-Gaweh families as Israeli settlers began immediately moving in. Al Jazeera's Shireen Tadros filed this report from the scene.
A family in despair after being forcibly evicted from a home they've lived in all their lives. Early Sunday morning, police broke into this house where the Hanun family were sleeping, dragging them kicking and screaming from their beds.
And they put us out, and they didn't let us, they didn't allow us to go inside. Then we're trying to go inside my home, because I can see my home there, it's empty. And I want to come back to my home soon, and I will.
As the family waited by the barrier, we heard police officers taunting them, saying they were in Israel, not Palestine now. Two families, the Rawi and the Hanouns, were evicted from their homes in East Jerusalem. Last year, they lost a long-running legal battle in the Israeli courts with Israeli settlers who claimed to own the property. The family have documents from 1956 proving the house was built and given to them by the United Nations and the Jordanian government. We're just across the street from the Hanun house. This is where the Rawi family live. We've been seeing police taking furniture out of their home for several hours now, and the police have cordoned off the whole area. Even the United Nations aren't being allowed to pass.
You don't have to push me.
I don't push you.
Yeah, you are.
Go out.
When we tried to get through, the police pushed us back. For Palestinians, this is just another example of Israel trying to lay claim to an increased Jewish presence in occupied East Jerusalem. Last November, another Palestinian family were evicted and settlers moved into their homes. Several eviction orders in this area are still outstanding.
They're planning to take house by house, and they claim that they own this all this neighborhood. But I'm sure that later they can't take any house from this neighborhood, because our lawyer, he have all the documents to prove that there is another Palestinian on this land.
The evictions come at a time when there's increasing pressure on Israel to stop settlement building on occupied Palestinian land meant to form part of a Palestinian state. Past evictions have caused an international outcry, but made little difference. Israel presses on with what many are describing as a cleansing of the Palestinian population from land internationally recognized as theirs. Shireen Tadros, Al Jazeera, occupied East Jerusalem.
Joining us to talk about what happened yesterday as he was forcibly removed from his home in occupied East Jerusalem is Maher Hanoun. Maher, welcome back to Flashpoints. We were all hoping that this day would never have come, that you and your family would have been afforded the simple privilege of continuing to live in your home. Thank you for being with us on the show today.
Thank you.
So let's talk about what happened yesterday. Tell us the story. Your family was attacked by Israeli forces yesterday morning.
Yesterday morning, early at 5, a lot of policemen came, as usual, full of weapons, and they broke the gate and the door and the windows, and they came in through the windows and the door, and they kicked out all the family and the international people and the Israelians. All of us, they kick us out by force.
And where are you now? You have a large family. Where are you staying?
Now, as I said before, if they kick us out, we don't have any place to go. And now I'm sleeping at the street until we see what will happen with my family. And also my furniture, after they took it, they leave it near the police station, and I took it. And I put my furniture and at empty land. So I don't found any place to my family to sleep and to my furniture to keep.
Maher, have the settlers already begun occupying your home?
That's what killing us, because I'm sleeping close to my house. And what killing me that I saw the settlers steal my house, and I see that, and I can do nothing, and all the world also saw that through the cameras, and they can stop the settlers steal our land and our houses.
That's the voice of Maher Hanoun. Maher and his family were forcibly removed from their home in occupied East Jerusalem by Israeli forces as settlers began moving in. And Maher, I know that this has been a lengthy legal battle for you and your community, who have gone to the Israeli courts again and again, and Israel has issued rulings in favor of the illegal settler groups instead of abiding by international law, which clearly states that the occupying force cannot transfer its citizens into the occupied territory. Yet we know that there are over 200,000 Israeli settlers inside occupied East Jerusalem alone, let alone the West Bank. And the settler groups and the settlement colonies are growing. Tell us about what the next legal steps are for you and the Chawe family.
You know, legally we don't have a big hope and big chance at the Israeli court. Our hope was, and now, to the political pressure, and the pressure also from the media and the international community. Because it's not fair what they did with us, and it's against the international law and against the human rights also. And as you know, East Jerusalem under occupation, and we are refugees, and they must stop transfer the refugees again and again. It's not fair that I am staying near my house and I can't enter to the place where I am born and where is my kids also born.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, with great fanfare, is heading off to Africa. And we wanted to take a look at some of the key issues and the key countries that might be impacted. And joining us to talk about the situation in the context of Congo is Kambale Musavali. He is the national spokesperson and student coordinator for Friends of the Congo. It is good to have you with us again. First of all, what's your response to Hillary Clinton? And if you were her advisor, what would you be advising her to get involved with? What kinds of actions would you support?
Yes, in regard to Secretary Clinton, with our visit to Africa and specifically to Congo, I was pleased to hear that she has taken on the issue of gender-based violence. But as if I was an advisor to her, I would make sure that she connect the raping of the people with the raping of the resources of the Congo. So it will be very critical that as she understands the violence against women in the Congo, to realize this is a direct result of the resource war, and she should promote an end to the conflict through aggressive diplomacy and sustained engagement of U.S. and British allies, Rwanda and Uganda. So in a visit there, she should meet with regional actors, such as Rwanda, Uganda, and Congolese key actors, and use a comprehensive political negotiations to end the conflict. It's a 12-year conflict. And not only that, it will be critical for her to hold U.S. corporations accountable for the plundering the resources by making those corporations to abide by OEC guidelines in the Congo and to increase transparency and decrease their role in fueling the conflict in the Congo. And that is the challenge as we Congolese are watching what's taking place now unfold. We hope she will connect the conflict to the resources. As we say, there are two tragedies taking place, the raping of the people and the raping of the land, and both are inextricably linked. And to end one, you must stop the other, as they are both connected.
Hillary Clinton has a reputation as a sort of an unabashed free trader. Some people are concerned that any action she takes is in the context of lining up corporate support for her presidential election. What corporations are at stake here, and how could she take in a very precise way, actions that don't support the corporations but support the people?
Oh, definitely. Specifically speaking about U.S. corporations, we know they have not abided by OEC guidelines. And one I can use as an example is Freeport-McMoRan. They have their base in Louisiana. When we have U.S. taxpayers, they were able to displace Congolese population and put them in tents. And American taxpayers do not know that. What she could do is review the involvement of the Overseas Private Investment Corporation and make sure that taxpayers' money are not funding corporations who are exploiting the people. The Carter Center has also given a lot of recommendation on U.S. companies who are exploiting the Congo, so she should look at the Carter Center recommendation as well as the United Nations recommendation for companies they have also found exploiting the Congo. In the United Nations report of 2002, they documented 85 multinationals illegally exploiting the resources of the Congo, and they've given strong recommendations on action to take to hold them accountable for OEC guidelines, to stop them from bribing politicians, to stop them from funding rebel militias, and take aggressive actions against them. But what we saw with the past administration is that none of the companies that we know are exploiting the resources have had any reprimand from the government. So with Obama now in office and sending Hillary to the continent, it's one thing to speak about the rebel militias and the people committing the massacre. But if you are not connecting them with the funding source, who are U.S.-based corporations and British corporations, then the conflict will perpetuate. And it will take engagement of regular citizens who are listening to this radio show now to send a letter to Hillary Clinton whenever she comes back from Africa, letting her know that it's a very good step to see the United States engage and follow what Obama said in Ghana. No, America should be partner of Africans, by a partner of peace, not a partner of exploitation, and engage her in conversations on how to put pressure on external forces while providing the support of the local people using the Millennium Goals and different other projects, because ultimately, what is at stake in the Congo is the control of the resources that is essential to the military, aerospace, and technology industry, as stated by the Congressional Budget Office here in the U.S. So regular citizen can play a key role in breaking the silence around the atrocities and sending her letters, letting her know that we should hold our corporation accountable. We should watch where our taxpayers' money is going. We should stop the militarization of the Congo by pushing AFRICOM as a form of human humanitarian help when it's a military operation. So Americans should be informed, take affirmative actions, and put pressure on the State Department to hold U.S. corporations accountable.
Finally, as you alluded to earlier, Hillary Clinton has expressed great concern in terms of the gender violence and the impact on women. How exactly is this pro-corporate policy, this pro-Western corporate policy, specifically devastating and hurting the lives of women and children?
The gender-based violence in the Congo is connected directly to the mineral wealth of the Congo, as I mentioned earlier. So the corporations for 12 years have benefited tremendously to the chaos that is taking place. You know, Freeport-McMoRan, you have Cabot Corporation, you have OM Group out of Ohio. Now we even have New York companies such as Pegasus, Castle & Company out of New York, and the list goes on. We have the extensive list in our website. But as the chaos has occurred, we saw channels where the resources of the Congo have went through Rwanda and Uganda and found its way into our modern technology, in our cell phone, speaking of the mineral called coltan, which is found in cell phone, laptop, DVD player, VCR, pacemakers, even night vision goggle using the military have coltan in it. But as we see that, and we see that Rwanda and Uganda, who are U.S. allies, have been given carte blanche to exploit the resources, that policy has to change. This was the policy of the Bill Clinton administration in the 90s. This was also the policy of the Bush administration in the new millennium. With Obama, we want him to change those policies. We cannot watch 6 million people killed in the heart of the continent, and yet do nothing about the corporations fueling the conflict. We cannot see 500,000 women raped just to get to the resources that is found in our cell phone, and don't hold our corporation accountable. We should change that policy and have aggressive diplomacy with the two staunchest U.S. allies, Rwanda and Uganda, to stop plundering the resources. And with that, as it has been documented by the United Nations, and the Carter Center have given recommendations on how they should put pressure on those corporations to put pressure on the supply chain to stop funding the rebel militias, those killings are going to end. But they are both inextricably linked. So the challenge for us, the conflict in the Congo, is not just a Congolese issue. It's not just an African issue. It's an issue of world concern because 6 million members of humanity have died simply because of the rings of our phones and the blings of our lives with the diamonds also that we have. So what we are calling for is for ordinary people to do extraordinary things. We have people organizing across the world, students joining the Breaking the Silence movement where they're organizing events, bringing the legislator, inviting them there, hosting, connecting with the youth of the Congo and have the voice of the Congolese heard throughout the world, because when Congo is at peace and can realize its potential, as Belgian agronomist has stated, Congo could feed the whole population of the world until 2050 when the population reached 9 billion. It has the hydro capacity to provide electricity to the whole continent of Africa, Southern Europe, and a part of Asia. The second largest rainforest in the world is the second long after the Amazon, so it's very essential to global warming. So what's taking place in Congo is critical. Even now as we're speaking, they are taking uranium out of Congo, which is very dangerous because the uranium that was used to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki came from the Congo. Today as we speak, there is illegal trade of uranium there. That could become something that will affect all of us. So we all have to look at this. And as Hillary Clinton and Ambassador Johnny Carson come back from the continent and let him know what Frantz Fanon said, let us never forget that the fate of us all is at stake in the Congo, and make sure that we end the worst conflict since World War II.
Kambale Musavuli, he is the national spokesperson and student coordinator for Friends of the Congo. You can get more information on that group at www.friendsofthecongo.org. That's www.friendsofthecongo.org. We thank you so much for the crucial information and being with us today on Flashpoints.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
You're quite welcome.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Coming up next, we bring you an update on the case of the South Bronx-based hip-hop group Rebel Diaz, who are connecting their local struggles for immigrant rights against police brutality and gentrification with struggles for justice worldwide. New York City-based journalist and educator Jaisal Noor reports for Flashpoints.
On June 18, 2008, Rodrigo and Gonzalo Venegas were walking on Westchester Avenue in the Hunts Point neighborhood of the Bronx in New York City. They observed a street vendor they say was being harassed by the police. Gonzalo says,
we had a friend of ours from Chicago who was visiting. He wanted to take a look around the Bronx. He wanted a little bit of a tour. So we were actually taking him to go see the famous Big Pun mural. On the way there, we happened upon this scene where there's a number of police officers picking up this street vendor who was selling fruits and vegetables, picking up all of his produce and throwing it in the back of a dump truck. We paused. The street vendor looked bewildered, like I imagine anybody's face would be if they're having their livelihood taken away. We approached the street vendor, who didn't speak English, and for that reason didn't understand the reasons behind having his livelihood taken away.
The brothers offered to translate for the vendor.
So I would say that we intervened with the intention of facilitating the dialogue between the police and the street vendor.
Gonzalo says the police were immediately hostile, adding,
obviously the police didn't like it. My brother has long braids. I was wearing a hat. I think I had a mohawk and sunglasses on at that moment. When you have NYPD that's trained to look at young people of color as criminals, as dangerous, their instinct is to pretty much write us off as just that, criminals.
When they asked the police for badge numbers, they were aggressively arrested.
As we came to find out a little later on while we were sitting in Central Booking, is, asking for a police officer's badge number in the South Bronx is a one-way trip to Central Booking.
The incident was caught on video.
nothing, man.
We don't do nothing.
Rodrigo and Gonzalo Venegas were charged with assaulting a police officer. However, the police backed down from that charge after the video was put on YouTube. The two remaining misdemeanors included obstruction of justice and resisting arrest. Rodrigo, or Rodstars, and Gonzalo, or G1, are part of the group Rebel Diaz, along with Teresita Ayala, or La Terra. Through their music and activism, Rebel Diaz have joined other community groups in resisting continued gentrification in the South Bronx. Rodrigo says,
that is the reason that they are doing immigrant street vendor sweeps. That is the reason why they're, you know, arresting young people for trespassing while they're trying to visit their grandma in the projects.
Over 30 organizations and supporters from across the Bronx and as far away as Germany wrote letters of support. Rodrigo's lawyer, Leah Horowitz, included them in a motion for dismissal filed in March. On June 18, 2009, a year to the day after their arrest, Judge Darcel Clark granted their motion. Horowitz says the vocal support of the community
impressed a court system that isn't easily impressed and isn't easily affected by those sorts of things.
Claudia de la Cruz, a resident of the South Bronx and pastor at San Romero's de la Americas Church in Washington Heights, wrote a letter of support. Claudia de la Cruz.
I was there in the court yesterday, and I feel like it was a victory not only for Rebel Diaz, but it was a victory for our communities. And so it was a happy moment, you know, because it was a moment when justice was actually served.
Despite their victory, Gonzalo says the fight must go on.
The outcome of this case is real easy to come to the conclusion that the system works. I would say it's not so much that the system works, that the system has cracks.
He says the ordeal strengthened their bonds to the community. He continues,
in the process of fighting the case, we opened a community center here in the South Bronx, four blocks away from the precinct that locked us up.
Rebel Diaz emphasizes they are committed to fighting for justice, not only in the South Bronx, but across the country and the world. Rebel Diaz performed in a fundraiser the night before their charges were dropped. They raised money for George Galloway's Viva Palestina convoy, bringing aid to the blockaded and devastated Gaza Strip.
For us, when we say that this music is resistance, it's the voice of the poor, is that whenever you trace culture of our people, it's going to take you back to resistance. Because we've been oppressed our whole histories. So when we talk about international struggles, we got to make that connection. I can't sit here and fight against gentrification in the South Bronx and ignore the situation in Gaza. I can't sit here and talk about police brutality in Brooklyn or in Harlem and not talk about, you know what I'm saying, people being assassinated in Oaxaca because they being displaced to Mexico. I can't talk about Palestine and not talk about independence for Puerto Rico. If we not making them connections, we blinded. You know, and that's the problem with the movement. We got to start talking about things, you know, in a real landscape. This is what's going down. The world is under attack.
Gonzalo says the judge's final words affirms their work.
The outcome of this case and the words that the last words that the judge left us with, which were, you know, keep up the good work, I think is keep up the good fight. You know what I'm saying? And that's what we're doing.
That was the South Bronx-based hip-hop group Rebel Diaz. And that report comes from Jaisal Noor in New York City. Noor is a journalist and educator reporting on grassroots resistance movements across the globe. He's a frequent contributor to the New York Independent newspaper. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
See, I gotta draw a line. I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you mean?
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.